This interview with Dr. Jill Tarter, Director of the Center for SETI Research, is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
You're Jill Tarter at the SETI Institute. Now, the SETI Institute is world famous.
Oh.
Tell us a little bit about the SETI Institute and your work in it.
Well, for those people who don't understand SETI, it stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and it's located in Mountain View, California. And although we do at the Institute a wide range of astrobiology, my group actually uses radio telescopes around the world to search for evidence of someone else's technology.
Okay, so it's not simply just looking for messages from ET or extraterrestrial intelligent life. You're looking for any kind of evidence that they exist rather than direct messages.
That's right. It would probably be easier for us to find a message that was deliberately sent because someone's gone to some effort to make it stronger and directed towards us. But indeed, there is some probability that we could eavesdrop on someone's radar system, an advanced technology which was trying to avoid a collision with asteroids, or someone who had an interplanetary civilization and therefore was sending, is it the rugby games from one planet to another?
Very good. So tell us about the telescopes that you use. You mentioned you use radio telescopes. Which ones do you predominantly use and how do you use them?
Well, we've used telescopes all over the world. We've been to Australia and used Parkes and MOPRA. In the U.S., we've used the National Radio Astronomy Observatory Telescope in Green Bank and an old telecom dish in Georgia that we refurbished to do SETI. And indeed, we've observed here at Jodrell Bank and used Jodrell in conjunction with Arecibo at the same time. We tried in the past to use two telescopes that were widely separated in order to help us discriminate, to sort out signals that are of our own making rather than ones that might be coming from the stars.
Right, so you needed to make sure that you weren't listening to Radio Greenland or something like that from the other side of our own world.
That's right. More like radars and overflying airplanes and satellites. But yes, we hear a lot of our own signals and have to filter that out.
So do you use these telescopes directly for SETI, or can other astronomers use the information for other means? Or is there a dedicated SETI search? Have there been dedicated SETI searches in the past?
Well, in the past, when we've been using these telescopes, they've been assigned to us. So we've applied for time and had as much as 5% of the time here at Jodrell and at Arecibo, which is a lot. That's for a lot any particular program. But that also meant that 95% of the time we're off the air. So what we're doing right now is building our own telescope. And we're building it in a way that when we do SETI, radio astronomers can do traditional studies with the telescope at the same time. So we're aiming to be on the air 24/7. And that will be new and exciting and fabulous. And we're going to dedicate that telescope, the first part of it, on the 11th of October.
So these other astronomers will be using your telescope, which you've got funding for and are going to build, to do their astronomy research, which may or may not include looking for extraterrestrial life. They might be doing, well, whatever research topics they want to pursue. Yet you, at the same time, will be doing the search for extraterrestrial signals.
That's right. We've built the telescope as an array. So multiple telescopes, and they're all small. They're each dish is only 6 meters in diameter, which means that when the signals from all the telescopes, and right now we have 42 and are looking to grow it to 350 of these dishes, but when the signals from these telescopes are combined, end up looking at a very large piece of the sky all at once. And so we put different back ends, different detectors, at the telescope. And for example, my radio astronomy colleagues can use something called an imaging correlator to essentially make a radio picture of that big piece of the sky. And each pixel can be investigated in frequency range, so there'll be a number of frequency channels associated with it. So it's a radio camera, a wide field radio camera for them. And for me, I combine the signals from all the telescopes in a slightly different way, so that instead of looking and seeing a picture from all these pixels on the sky, I actually pick out a handful of pixels and I steer the beams around so that the pixels I select are in the directions of stars that are like our own sun, where there's a probability that there might be planets and intelligence and technology. And I can therefore stare at these individual pixels, take my data on the individual stars. At the same time, my colleagues are measuring the amount of hydrogen in the local galaxy, or timing the arrival of signals from a network of pulsars, the kind of thing that Jodrell does all the time.
Mm. So you are not interested in a large amount of the imaging which has been taken by the telescope array, just those pixels which are centered on stars, presumably because we'd like to think that alien life will live on planets similar to Earth, so they should orbit around stars, etc. So you're only interested in the signals which, you know, which might be coming from the pixels containing stars.
Well, that's our guess at the moment, that we should be investigating the vicinity of stars like the sun. Now, if I could, what I would do is take my signal detection equipment, which has hundreds of millions of spectral channels, and if I could build enough equipment, afford to do that, I'd put my equipment behind every single pixel in the field of view and look in all directions. It's just a question of the cost of,
yes,
of doing that.
So presumably you want to make sure that, well, first of all, we buy and install and use equipment which is going to be enough to cover the stars that we see in our radio map, but you'd like more, and you'd like to soak up as much information as you're looking at.
We would, and it will get cheaper in the future. After all, for us now, it's just mainly about computing, and Moore's Law means that next year we'll be able to compute more for the same price. Mm. And eventually, this is the kind of technology we'd like to go to. The square kilometer array is pushing in some of these exact same directions, a lot of spectral capability and a lot of pixels on the sky.
Now, you mentioned that your equipment is looking at a wide range of frequencies. I mean, you do this, why?
Well, because we don't know what frequency a signal might arrive at. We've made a guess in the radio part of the spectrum that the signals that are most obviously technological as opposed to astrophysical are ones where the energy is compressed into essentially a single channel on the radio dial, if you wish.
So because a natural process would be extremely difficult to achieve this, wouldn't it?
As far as we know, nature can't do this trick, mm-hmm. but technology can. But that's a single channel, and we don't know where on the radio dial that channel might be. So that means we have to investigate the whole portion of the radio spectrum that isn't that doesn't have a lot of extra noise.
So alien FM isn't from 88 to 110 megahertz or whatever.
Well, it might be.
It might be, but
we don't know that yet. But what we've done is take a look at the radio spectrum, and we know that at lower frequencies there's excess noise due to electrons that are spinning around the magnetic field in the Milky Way galaxy. That produces a radio hiss, which is noise to us. And at higher frequencies, oxygen and water vapor in our own atmosphere create additional noise. So from 1,000 megahertz to 10 gigahertz, there's a quiet window. And that's where we're trying to observe. So if I look from 1 gigahertz to 10 gigahertz, I've essentially got 10 billion channels to search through.
10 billion channels, that's amazing. And many people might be aware of or know of the SETI at Home program, and that's related to this problem of observing many, many channels in frequency space, isn't it?
It is. SETI at Home is an attempt to get a lot of telescope time very inexpensively, and to do it by piggybacking on other astronomers' radio science. So SETI at Home can't point the telescope. It can't manage to look at particular stars or particular directions, but it can soak up all of the signals that are being collected by radio astronomers for their purposes, and it looks at just a small amount of the frequency band because of the limits of recording technology. Mm-hmm. It looks at about 2 megahertz, so a couple of million channels right around the hydrogen line, and it's opposed to building signal detectors and special back-end hardware. What the SETI at home people have very cleverly done is just to record the data and then cut it up in frequency and time and ship it out to you so that you can use your home computer as a spectrometer to look for signals in that small work package, and then send the results back, and they're collected with everyone else's results, put through lots of different sieves and filters to get rid of our own signals, and looking for any residual, anything that's left over that we didn't know about that might be an extraterrestrial signal.
And this was essentially a pioneering idea, because people realized that many people's computers at home were sitting there most of the time on, yet not doing anything. There was lots of computer power out there, but wasn't being utilized. So they were able to realize that if people are interested in joining the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, they could do this at home with their computer by downloading, you know, as you say, a chunk of information and searching for it.
Right. Distributed computing was not invented by SETI at home. It's been around for a long time, this idea of taking a big problem and spreading it among a large number of machines. But not many people were doing it. Folks who were trying to break codes or factor Marcin primes or some other kind of esoteric mathematical problem. But then SETI was such a sexy idea that people really got galvanized by this, and there are more than 5 million people have downloaded this screensaver. There are at any moment, there are about 50,000 users processing the data. And in every country of the world, it's just captured people's imaginations. And now there are many other at-home projects. You can use your home computer to fold proteins for cancer research. You can look for pieces of dust grain in the data that's been returned from the Stardust sample mission. You can count craters. You can do all kinds of other at-home projects, Einstein at home. Lots of good science can be done this way by people who are interested.
In particular, of course, we're talking about SETI, but as you mentioned, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence captures the imagination of so many people in ways which other science activities cannot. What's the interest, as far as you can tell? Why are people so, you know, caught up with the idea of alien life?
Well, it's a fundamental question. I think probably when the earliest ancestors walked out of the caves and looked up at the sky and saw these lights, they wondered what they were. And as we began to understand that those stars are suns, the idea that other people might live around other suns is a very old one. And we just want to understand our place. We want to know whether we're alone in this cosmos or whether there are other creatures that explore their universe as well. It's a fundamental question. Are we alone?
And it would be a ridiculous thing for me to ask, but I'm going to ask anyway. Do you believe that alien life does exist in the universe?
Well, actually, you used the wrong verb. Belief has nothing at all to do about it. We spent millennia asking the priests and the philosophers what to believe about life somewhere else. This is science. And we finally, starting in the middle of the 20th century, began to have tools that would allow scientists and engineers to try and do experiments to answer this fundamental old question. And so we're trying. We're observing. We're asking the question and trying to answer it. We don't know what the answer is.
Can we set some limits or some probability on whether alien life exists?
We can try. But in the end, basically, all we're doing is organizing our ignorance. Frank Drake, back in the 1960, developed what's called the Drake Equation. And it's a series of different probabilities that you multiply one by another, starting with the number of stars and the number of planets that might be habitable and what fraction of them actually host life and what fraction of that life becomes intelligent and how often does that intelligence produce a civilization and technology, and how long does it hang around? Are technological civilizations long-lived or not? Those are various factors in the Drake Equation that we try and estimate. But in the end, you've got a big estimation and one guess multiplied by another. And so My own personal philosophy is not to calculate the probability, but to do the observation.
Absolutely. We need the information first before we even start to speculate about anything else. I mean, as you say, our ignorance about some of these elements of the Drake equation when we want to start multiplying probabilities is quite large. So essentially the result...
Our ignorance is profound. We should never forget that.
A lot of people have said that, well, nothing has been found yet, so why should we continue with our search for alien signals?
Well, we've been searching for 40 years, a little bit more than that. But we haven't been searching all the time. We've been on the telescope a small fraction of the time, and we've had relatively primitive tools. So we haven't searched very much of the possible space to explore. It's many dimensions. It's not only frequency that's unknown, but we don't know where on the sky, when a signal might arrive. We don't know what information is encoded, if any, on it. Therefore, it's hard to build a matched filter. There's just a vast space to explore, and the universe is very large indeed. So even if we're trying to simply look at our own Milky Way galaxy, we've not even scratched the surface of the possible volume to be explored. And the good news is that we're now beginning to have the tools to do a systematic search. The Allen Telescope Array, which we're going to dedicate in a few days now, will be the first telescope that can be dedicated 24/7 to do SETI as well as radio astronomy. And our computers are getting faster. We're also looking for optical signals now that we can count photons very, very fast and avoid the background from the stellar light. Who knows whether tomorrow there will be a new technology that is developed that might also make sense in terms of looking for someone else's technology. There's a lot of space out there to mm-hmm. explore, and we're getting better at it.
Tell us a little bit about the Allen Array.
The Allen Telescope Array is an idea of building a very large radio telescope out of small pieces, individual antennas that are only 20 feet in diameter. With a lot of computing, you can combine the signals collected by all of the small antennas to make the equivalent of a very large antenna. And it not only has the sensitivity of a large antenna, but it has another capability, which is, since you've taken all that collecting area and put it into individual telescopes, they don't have to sit right next to each other. They can be spread out over large distances. And by doing that, you give the telescope better vision. It has the ability to spatially resolve much smaller objects, to have a finer view. So more pixels, if you wish, on the sky.
That's fantastic, exciting work. I mean, I just remember back in the day watching Carl Sagan and his Cosmos TV programs. I mean, did you meet Carl Sagan?
Carl actually was a colleague. I knew him quite well, and we certainly miss him. And we keep trying to find other spokespersons for science, for astronomy, that are as eloquent as Carl. And it's a very hard job to fill, so we miss him.
Well, I have to say that probably one of the reasons I became an astronomer was watching Carl Sagan, just being infected by his enthusiasm for astronomy and science in general.
That's true. Carl turned on a whole generation of young people. It's wonderful.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much indeed for taking the time to chat with us, and we wish you best for the search.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.